Welcome back to another episode of LSHTM Viral, where we bring you the latest science around the novel coronavirus pandemic, straight from the experts. My name is Naomi, and today we are speaking to Francesco Checchi. Francesco is a professor of epidemiology and international health here at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. His specialty is quantitative public health measurement and disease control in crisis settings, including armed conflict, natural disasters, and epidemics. Francesco, you've just published a paper with a team of mathematical modelers and other academics here at LSHTM, looking at the impact of COVID-19 specifically in Africa. The paper notes that the health impact of COVID-19 may be more severe in African settings than in Europe or China due to demographic, epidemiologic, and socioeconomic factors. What are those factors, and why would it result in more severe impacts?
If you look at demography in sub-Saharan Africa and other low-income settings, what you do have on the plus side is younger populations. But on the other hand, most households are larger on average, and you have elderly people living generally with their extended families. Thus, one could expect that there's going to be a lot of transmission within households. There are also really crowded urban communities with very limited water and sanitation. So that doesn't really bode well in terms of transmission in some of these large cities such as Kinshasa or the slums around Nairobi. Beyond that, what we do have is a major concern in low-income countries and African settings in particular is a much higher frequency occurrence of some of the conditions that we know are associated with increased COVID severity, not so much in terms of them being more frequent as such, but rather that they are less frequently detected and far less well managed. We're talking about things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, kidney disease. And then on top of that, you have other conditions, tuberculosis, HIV, potentially undernutrition, that we don't know a lot about yet in terms of how they affect COVID, but that are really much more frequent in low-income countries in Africa. So if you put all of that together, what that amounts to really is a very worrying picture in terms of both the extent to which the virus could be transmitted in these settings, but also the risk to individuals if they become infected in terms of developing severe disease and also becoming critical cases. And on the very last point, what is perhaps most concerning is the baseline state of health services in these countries. The fact that you have countries such as Burkina Faso that currently have only 9 intensive care beds. Central African Republic has got 1 or 2. Few other countries are a bit luckier in terms of their starting point. But nevertheless, what we expect is that most of these countries would have to ramp up their treatment capacity by something like 50 to 500 times more than what they have now. And so I think, unfortunately, the reality is that in many places, there's going to be very limited treatment, and that could increase the mortality much more compared to what we've seen so far in China and Europe.
Who are the vulnerable populations across Africa?
We know, of course, from what we've seen so far in China and other high-income places, that age is a major predictor of how severe cases might be. But I think that in sub-Saharan Africa and other low-income settings, it's plausible that what we call biological age is a little bit different. In other words, that a 60-year-old in somewhere like Mali or Niger might be the equivalent of a 70-year-old here in Europe in terms of his or her vulnerability. So I think we have to probably take that into account as a starting point. And we've suggested so far to really look at the 60 plus as being a particular risk in African settings. We're thinking, in fact, that maybe we need to lower that even further to 50-year-olds and beyond. And then in addition to the age criterion, if you like, for being vulnerable, there's basically what I was talking about before, i.e. the prevalence of all of these other conditions that do in fact occur in earlier age in a lot of African settings. If you think about HIV and TB, they affect not just old people, but younger age cohorts. And so we're very worried that the spectrum of severe disease in African settings and other low-income settings might really shift toward younger groups.
So what are your suggestions to protect them?
I think broadly, our starting point was that it might be nearly impossible to scale up treatment capacity, quite frankly, particularly if you're starting out with a very, very low baseline. So in a way, what you're instead looking at as realistic options is a range of preventive interventions, including people with symptoms, self-isolating, general physical social distancing, with an extreme case of that being lockdown measures, but also a strategy that we are putting forward, an approach we're putting forward that we call shielding, whereby these vulnerable people we've talked about are specifically protected by making sure that they have as little physical contact as possible with the rest of the population. The reason why we are in particular thinking of the latter option is because in some of the settings we're talking about, economics is a major limiting factor in terms of the extent to which countries can actually impose lockdowns. Even in the UK, of course, we are already seeing the economic consequences of what has it been now, about a month of lockdown. But the difference between the UK and somewhere like Tanzania is that we have the ability here to provide a massive rescue package that somehow keeps the economy afloat. Whereas in a lot of low-income countries, that economic flexibility is not there. Economies are not really set up for working from home. And therefore, there's a real risk that lockdown measures are A, unfeasible potentially, or B, very harmful in many different ways, particularly if they are maintained for a long time. And I think someone actually made the point, which I think feels very apt and very eloquent to me, that the trade-off here is not between lives and economics, but rather between lives and lives, meaning that you could save lives through a lockdown, but you could also cause a lot of lives lost down the line because of the increased poverty, increased undernutrition that would come with a lockdown.
How do these suggestions with an emphasis on shielding differ from public health measures that have taken place in other countries across the world?
We have shown in the paper that, at least epidemiologically, lockdowns do work, much as we are seeing here in Europe. For example, if you impose a lockdown of about 2 months and it is effective, you can expect that you can essentially delay the epidemic by something like 3 months, gaining precious time to plan and to mobilize resources. But you know, what we haven't done, but we can sort of assume, is that lockdowns are, as I was discussing, quite harmful in many different ways. And we haven't actually calculated, estimated all of those indirect harms, if you like, that really should be put on the balance. So what we are saying, I think, is, you know, if a lockdown is acceptable for a given amount of time, if it is socially feasible, then it is helpful to at least delay the epidemic, but there needs to be an exit strategy. And what we propose as a reasonable exit strategy is a combination of this shielding approach that I was talking about earlier, whereby all the vulnerable people, or as many of the vulnerable people as possible, are protected from physical contact with others for a given amount of time. So shielding on the one hand, and on the other hand, moderate measures that promote physical distancing within the general population, such as increased hand washing, curtailment of unnecessary gatherings, you know, things that are not really on a scale such as to interrupt economies. The idea would be that these measures allow economies to remain viable. The shielding approach, that would be one of its theoretical advantages. You are shielding people who, for the most part, are no longer economically active, or are, if you like, a minority of the population. So you're allowing most of the economy to continue functioning while protecting those who are most at risk.
You've mentioned the involvement of other sectors and fields, for instance, water, sanitation, and hygiene, commonly known as WASH. Are we considering how to give resources to those areas that are also important in the pandemic response?
I have to say what I see mainly, unfortunately, is an emphasis on measures that I think are increasingly becoming yesterday's problem. So things like border closures and quarantines, trying to contain transmission from the outside, as well as an emphasis on trying to scale up treatment, case management, which is, of course, very admirable. But as I was saying before, really might be very challenging given the amount of severe cases and critical cases that these health systems would have to cope with. So I think that actually preventive interventions are key. And talking about WASH in particular, anything that rapidly increases people's access to water, as well as basic commodities such as soap, cleaning supplies, anything along those lines would be very, very useful, even if it is something fairly high level, such as subsidizing water and soap so that it is essentially free for populations for a given amount of time.
In many places, there are recent gains in the health of populations as a result of improved clinical settings and healthcare access. For instance, women being able to give birth in a clinic or access to medication that's necessary for malarial treatments. How might public health measures around COVID-19 affect those in Africa?
Well, this is another big area of concern. I think the consequences could be threefold. On the one hand, resources might be siphoned away from routine health services to respond to the COVID epidemic, which is, of course, to some extent justifiable, but essentially would result in disruptions in terms of these health services, potentially with fairly long-term consequences. So things like a routine vaccination might very well see disruptions that in turn could result in epidemics or greater burden of childhood infections down the line. On the other hand, I think that there's a real risk to clinicians in Africa from both working in treatment facilities for COVID, but also simply from remaining functional within routine health services, given the number of cases of COVID, symptomatic and potentially asymptomatic as well, that those clinicians will be exposed to. We know already that if you look at Italy, for example, they have lost more than 100 medical doctors already during their COVID response, which is tragic, but of course happens in a country that has a very large cadre of clinicians. Whereas if we look to Africa, one of the scarcest resources is actually human resources for health, doctors and nurses. And there's a real risk that a lot of these frontline caregivers would fall sick and worse, succumb to the virus, which wouldn't just be a tragedy on a human level. It would also essentially be a major loss in terms of the health systems, in terms of one of the key pillars of health systems. And by the way, replacing clinicians takes years, right? Of years of education and training. So I've mentioned, I think, two big issues. So on the one hand, diversion of resources. On the other hand, at risk to clinicians. I would say that the third threat is just that health services are completely overloaded, overburdened by the large number of severe and critical cases that present to health facilities. Unless there's a strategy in place to protect these health services through pretty advanced triage, separation of COVID from other patients, there's a real danger that, to me, that a lot of health facilities simply become non-functional because of the onslaught of patients. It's perhaps an overly gloomy prediction, but I really should stress that if we go with the current forecast, we are heading into a situation that is entirely unprecedented for the African continent in terms of the levels of pressure on its health services over a very short span of time.
That's an interesting point that you and the other authors have raised in the paper. How do we encourage continued international assistance to low-income settings while countries and individuals are focused on battling the pandemic within their own borders?
Continuing to rely on foreign aid and not withdrawing foreign aid to repurpose it for economic rescue packages in our countries, I think, would be important. After all, let's not forget that the COVID threat won't end anywhere unless everyone everywhere is protected or has access to a vaccine, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very much a global effort in which we are all interdependent. So it's a good use of money to help low-income countries manage their COVID epidemics. I think there are some very practical measures that would help. For example, there's a real hoarding of PPE supplies, gloves, masks, aprons, and the like by rich countries currently. For example, the Sudanese Ministry of Health is trying desperately to procure PPE supplies, and it just is unable to do so on the market. And that means, based on what we were just talking about, an even greater risk to clinical staff in these countries, but also, if you like, the inability to provide any COVID case management, because one of the pillars is precisely having access to steady supply chains of PPE. So, you know, I think it's a mixture of generosity, as well as redoubled efforts in terms of aid and in terms of supporting development and humanitarian actors in these countries to remain functional and continue doing their work. I would want to see much greater leadership from the UN, the World Health Organization, but I think even further up from the United Nations itself on this. There may be an opportunity in the next few weeks as China and Europe and North America come out of lockdown and perhaps have a period of time during which incidence here of cases here in our countries is lower. That may be an opportunity to revisit this issue and actually address the hoarding issue. But I think the initiative would need to come from the UN, from the World Bank, from key players and perhaps key champion governments, including perhaps important or powerful countries in the global south, such as South Africa, India, to kind of essentially leverage their influence and force a change in this.
The paper also notes that preventative strategies are not always foreclosed to African governments and societies that receive assistance, be that from the private sector, international aid groups. Why would that be the case, and what can we do about it?
There may be a sense that nothing can be done, right? And despair may set in, because if you simply look at the number of cases expected in a country like Nigeria that we did some modeling of, at peak, we estimated they might require something like 200, 250,000 beds just to deal with COVID cases. So if you look at that as a decision maker, you may just decide that there is too high a mountain to climb. But I think what we wanted to say in the papers is, yes, that unfortunately these countries, based on the evidence we've got now, are heading towards very severe epidemics with very large losses of lives. But on the other hand, that a lot of the loss of lives, as well as the extraordinary pressure on health systems, can be mitigated if you put in place intelligent, realistic strategies to protect those most vulnerable and to reduce general contacts within the population without necessarily wrecking economies in the long term. So we did want to sound that somewhat hopeful note, at least on the basis of the modeling findings that we came up with. But on the other hand, it's an effort that is likely to require much more than governments alone. I think that it's going to be a job for everyone, much as it is here. At the end of the day, it very much depends on us all as individuals, as citizens, to kind of adapt our lives and help each other through behavior change, but also I think in countries that have limited resources and limited resilience, one will hope to see an approach that is likely to help is to really allow communities, empower communities to lead the response themselves, to take steps themselves, allow civil society, faith-based groups, wealthy citizens, the diaspora to all chip in, rather than having very top-down, militarized, coercive policies by governments.
What is the key message then for African decision makers?
My key messages would be to focus very heavily on preventing transmission as a pillar of any country strategy. And within that, to consider the option of empowering communities to shield their vulnerable family members from COVID through a variety of arrangements.
Thank you, Francesco, for those insightful comments on the COVID-19 response in Africa and what really needs to be done to prevent the pandemic from becoming worse. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of LSHTM Viral. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player and rate us on Apple Podcasts.